about this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And it is just a few seconds before 11 a.m. on KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. He speaks with herbalist Hani Bellabono today about her book, Women Healers of the World, The Traditions, History, and Geography of Herbal Medicine. And then at 11:30, stay tuned for Jenka Soderberg. She will be interviewing Alex Gates, a student at PSU and organizer in the PSU Student Union, about the administration's push for campus security to become a fully sworn police force. And we want to thank you, KBOO listeners, and for all your fantastic support during our recent membership drive. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Lent's International Farmers Market, a program of Zengu Farm, every Sunday through October at Southeast 92nd and Foster from 10 to 3. Lent's Farmers Market offers the Food Scouts Farmers Market Club for kids, a community table, cooking demonstrations, and live music. More at lentsfarmersmarket.org.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, herbalist Hani Bellabono, is director of Vineyard Herbal Teas and Apothecary and director of the Bellabono School of Herbal Medicine. She's also the author of several books, including The Essential Herbal for Natural Health and The Authentic Herbal. And she's here today on Health Watch to talk about her latest, Women Healers of the World, The Traditions, History, and Geography of Herbal Medicine. Welcome to Health Watch, Hani Bellabono.
Hi, David. Thanks. It's good to be here.
So why don't we acquaint our listeners to the story around how you came to write this book?
Well, I've been an herbalist for a long time, about 20 years, and over the course of that time, really enjoyed working with plants. That was the key focus for me. But it slowly grew and grew to where my focus included the people who work with plants, as well as the plants themselves. And by that, I mean, my eyes were opened to the people, men and women throughout time, who have worked with plants, who have studied plants, and who have healed other people in a medicine capacity with plants. And the more I realized how much people, you know, how much of a heritage it is with people, the more I realized that women were underrepresented in science and medicine and research. Typically, I can name a good handful or more of men who are considered botanists or chemists or researchers, and I just can't really name many women. When I first started this project, I could name maybe Elizabeth Blackwell and Florence Nightingale, Marie Curie, and that was about it. And I thought, you know, women are very underrepresented, but it's herbalism and working with plants and this healing is very much a woman's genre, if you will. Herbalism is very much in the realm of women's work and healing and being in the home and working in the garden, harvesting and crafting. And I thought it would be very special to honor the women who have contributed to this heritage. And so I began interviewing women that I had met at herbal conferences, Rosemary Gladstar, Susan Weed, Cascade Anderson Geller, just with a few basic questions, and it grew from there. I would mention my project to someone, and they would say, oh, do you know this woman in Peru who runs an orphanage, and she teaches all of the children at her orphanage how to use calendula and different herbs in her greenhouses, both for in their kitchen, but also she trains them how to make herbal medicines and take care of themselves. And so I contacted this woman. That was Mama Kia Ingenlath. And she became part of my book. And someone else said, you know, do you know this woman in Scotland? Her name is Mary Beath, and she chronicles Gaelic pharmacy and records all of the ancient folklore and protocols associated with really a vanishing system of medicine. So I contacted her, and she became part of it. So it really grew very naturally, just from a desire to celebrate these women and let other people know that they were out there.
Well, one of the really interesting and compelling parts of the book also was seeing the resistance and that a lot of these women healers had from either the government or from authorities or from maybe people in their own families even, and their persistence around overcoming it. Could you talk about some examples of some women healers and what they had to go through around the overarching society and their opposition to it?
Yeah, generally these women have been very persistent. They're very tenacious ladies. They worked really hard to pursue what was important to them. For instance, one of the women that I talked with is Doña Enriqueta Contreras, who is a Oaxacan midwife in Mexico, a Zapotecan midwife. She very early on, when she was still a child, learned midwifery and became the community's choice as a midwife because she was very good at it, and people felt safe with her, and she had a lot of knowledge, empirical knowledge, hands-on, that she had gained from working with other people and being present at birth, but also from being present at animal births, because she was around goats and had spent a lot of time as a child around goats and had seen what was a very natural process. And her knowledge led her to become a very well-respected and in-demand midwife, at least for the women, the mothers who were giving birth. The men, unfortunately, in her society and culture at the time, were not as supportive. She was more expected to stay at home and not have a job and not have money coming in and not to travel, because she traveled all over the various states of Mexico to provide these services. And it was very difficult for her and her family, because her husband was not supportive, the other men in the community were not supportive. It actually became rather risky for her to pursue this. She told me that she was even involved in a drive-by shooting. Somebody shot at her, and she believes it was because she was not the stay-at-home wife that was expected of her. But she persevered, and over the course of 60 years, she helped deliver more than 2,000 babies. Never once did she lose a mother or baby in childbirth, which I think is pretty phenomenal. And she's in her 70s now. She doesn't provide those services anymore, but she does teach. And she's very much a mentor for young women coming into healthcare, helping to emphasize to them how important it is that they get empirical, hands-on knowledge and not just study from a book.
Well, that brings up an interesting theme that reoccurs in women healers of the world too. You mentioned that traditionally herbalism is in the purview of women more than men, and there's definitely a sense in the book that it's a knowledge that's passed down from mentor to apprentice, and there's some tension in the histories of many of these women between accumulated wisdom or accumulated knowledge passed down from person to person versus the pressures to be certified or to have gone to a specific type of approved school. Can you talk a little bit about that in relationship to herbalism?
You mean the whole idea of being certified or a more organic approach from hands-on experience?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that somehow plays also into this gender differentiation. Not entirely, of course, but you do
Definitely. I understand what you're saying is that perhaps, you know, women haven't had the opportunity to get the training that they need to get certificates or licenses or degrees that would help them move forward in a healthcare capacity. And especially in herbal medicine, those things really don't exist. You can't get a license in herbal medicine in America. There is no license. There are certificates, but not a license. And now, there are more universities and colleges that are offering degrees in herbal medicine through, you know, a bachelor's in science or something similar.
But aren't there also herbalists who are ambivalent about whether there should be certification, that perhaps it should be preserved as a mentor-apprentice relationship?
Yeah, it's I don't want to say it's a big debate, but it's definitely an issue that is, you know, there's no great cohesion among herbalists of it should be this way, it should be that way. Everyone has their own opinion. And there is a large group of people who say, you know, there shouldn't be any certificates at all. It should still be very much a person-to-person, handed-down approach because it's a folk tradition. Herbal medicine is the people's pharmacy. You know, it's our birthright is to have this information about how to use plants, especially since the plants are in our backyard and they're right there. Everyone should have access to them and also the right to treat yourself in a health capacity. And so, sure, that in that respect, a certificate is not needed and could be cumbersome. It could actually stand in the way of somebody who really wanted to learn about the plants. It's not necessary. And on the other hand, a certificate can be useful for a student who wants to go into the a wider world of midwifery or nursing or naturopathy and apply that knowledge to credits in a school that they're in to show that they have put forth a number of hours and study and have accumulated a certain type of knowledge that isn't, you know, out there just for the taking, that you have to make an investment, and it's a form of commitment, and it shows that you've pursued a certain schooling. So there's both ways to look at certification.
Well, I like how you profile the whole spectrum today, because, you know, Western herbalism seems like a strange mix of Native American tradition, European herbal traditions, and then modern evidence-based research that's been done on herbs. And different herbalists are going to fall in different places on the spectrum. And on the one hand, you do have folk herbalists, but then you also have some medical doctors who are also from the line of herbalists. I think of Tiarona Lowdog, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Sure. There's a wide range of different ways and capacities that people get involved with herbal medicine. David Hoffman is another herbalist, not in the book, but he's from Wales and now, you know, has lived in America for a long time, and he's very much a kind of herbalist that focuses on pharmacology and the chemistry of plants. But I think he does he's interesting in that he also approaches medicine from a very spiritual perspective. Tiarona Lowdog that you mentioned, she's a physician, very well-known medical doctor, but she practiced early on in herbal medicine and midwifery, very hands-on plant-based studies that really piqued her curiosity, and she's one of those integrative physicians that really enjoys combining the folk traditions with modern medicine, which I think is really important. I think there should be a nice balance there. I don't think that you can have only herbal medicine, and I don't think you can have only modern or allopathic medicine. I think they combine and they complement each other so well.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to herbalist Holly Bellabono about her latest book, Women Healers of the World, The Traditions, History, and Geography of Herbal Medicine. Holly, could you talk about one of the ancient herbalists that you profile in the book? I know not all of the herbalists in the book are contemporary. And I was particularly interested in Maria, the alchemist, chemist from Alexandria, and the various devices that she invented that ended up changing chemistry in some ways.
She was a really neat one, yeah. So in the book, there are 21 contemporary women that I interviewed who are living today, and 10 ancient women. And of the ancient women, Maria Prophetisa was one. She was a Gnostic alchemist in Alexandria sometime around 100-200 AD. We're not sure exactly when. She was an interesting woman because she wrote a book called the Maria Practicum about her chemistry and research in her laboratory in Alexandria. The book is lost now. We don't have it, but there are historians that have referred to it, so we know that it did exist. And she, I like to imagine her as a real experimenter, that she was playing around. As an alchemist, you know, alchemists back then, their primary goal was to transform substances into gold. And she was a Gnostic. So as a Gnostic alchemist, I think she took it a little higher in the spiritual realm. Many Gnostics believed that the spirit was trapped in matter, and so they wanted to find ways to release the spirit and free the soul. And so you have all this transmutation going on. And in the process of these experiments, she led to the, or she discovered several things that we use today. She is credited by many sources today as the discoverer of hydrochloric acid, which probably was a mistake at the time. I don't think she was trying to discover that, but she is credited as the first person to isolate or create hydrochloric acid. And more importantly, at least for herbalists and perfumers today, homeopathics and naturopathics, anyone who uses hydrosols or essential oils, she created what she called the tribecos, which was basically the still. She was the person who invented this, the distillation machine. And it was a three-chambered machine where you took plants and basically steeped them in water until the water started to evaporate. And she devised a method using ceramic and clay and glass pipes to capture that steam that was evaporating and funnel it back into a place where it could be captured. And because the essential oils are volatile, they would rise with the steam and be captured. And that was the first instance of someone figuring out how to do that. And the reason that that's important today is because essential oils are widely used in perfumery, and they're extremely antibacterial. They can kill a lot of pathogens, funguses, bacteria, and so they're used in first aid and topical treatments for the skin, especially.
Well,
so that was quite a contribution from her, and granted, a lot of it is mysterious. We don't know for certain exactly what she did, but she did open the door for people to come after her and, build on her knowledge and her discovery and really create the industries that we have today.
Well, you mentioned the use of the essential oils for skin health, and you do have sections in the book that profile individual herbs and also go into some of the processes of how to make medicines. What would be some of the things that you mentioned in the book that, you know, a contemporary reader could potentially make or use for dealing with skin conditions?
Yeah.
Or for skin health?
Okay. Yeah, I have a chapter in the book called Handcrafting Traditions, which are recipes that are inspired by the women in this book. So they're very common. They're recipes for very common things, like a steam that you would inhale when you have a stuffy nose, or an ointment that you put on your skin to heal a wound. Very common traditional herbal methods, and I base them on the different women throughout the book and their favorite herbs or the way that they like to work with plants, just to give people a chance to use the book productively and make something of their own with it. So for instance, the steam and essential oils. A steam is so easy to make, and it can be very beneficial if your nose is stuffy or you have a sore throat. In the wintertime, you've got the, congested airways. You can take hot water and a few drops of essential oil, thanks to Maria Profetisa, put a towel over your head and hover over a bowl with the hot water and the essential oils, and that steam will rise and help clog your airways or declog. You can think about eucalyptus doing that. A lot of people use eucalyptus in spas because it's so fragrant, but it also can help dry up congested nasal passages. So that's easy. I really prefer, though, working with fresh plants, whole plants. And I really like to teach people to go out in the garden or in a field or in your city park or wherever you might be and learn to identify the plants that are around you and use those fresh. And one way to really do that is with an oil. And you can, say you go out and you find wild plantain or yarrow, or you have a garden and you're growing lemon balm or rosemary or sage. You can harvest these herbs fresh and chop them up. As long as they're not very wet, you want to keep everything pretty dry, and put them in a mason jar, and cover them up with an oil like canola or olive oil, some sort of thick kitchen oil, and then you put a lid on it, and you label it, which I have discovered is very important because you don't want to forget what's in it, and you let it sit for anywhere from 2 weeks to, say, 6 months. It's very forgiving. It can be a long time. And you shake it occasionally, and then you strain it. Alternatively, if you don't have that kind of time or you don't want to wait, you can do it on a saucepan on the stove on very low heat. Gently, gently heat through the oil with these herbs, and what happens is the plants release many of their chemicals into the oil. And so the oil becomes this infused medicine, so that when you do strain the leaves out, the oil is your menstruum or your medicine. And you can put that directly on your skin. For instance, if you've used yarrow, which is a wildflower, it's very astringent, and it also is antibacterial. That oil, which is infused with the yarrow, can be placed on cuts and scrapes. It can help reduce chances of infection. It can help soothe the skin. It can help tighten skin cells and astringe any sort of weepy sore. It's a very easy, easy folk remedy, and that's the kind of remedy that I really like people to learn about, because it makes it accessible, especially for children, for anyone wanting to learn about plants and making them more a part of your daily life. So those are good kitchen crafting remedies and a really nice way to begin your entry, your foray into herbal medicine.
And it sounds like a lot of these processes are easy for anybody to learn.
They're very simple. You know, you can get very complex, but you don't have to. Some of the things that are the easiest, for instance, a tea, an herbal tea, there isn't anything easier than harvesting some herbs, putting them in a pot, and pouring hot water over them. And that's the basis of an herbal tea or a tisane or an infusion. And that's an excellent way to get the vitamins and minerals out of a plant, to hydrate yourself at the same time, and to enjoy something really delicious, because a lot of these herbs taste very nice, and they're beneficial at the same time. So yeah, super simple, super easy, really welcoming, very forgiving, as I said. It's hard to go wrong. There might be a few handful of plants that you kind of want to avoid, poison ivy, poison oak, especially if you're pregnant or nursing, you have to take extra care. But for the most part, a lot of our wildflowers and garden plants make excellent herbal remedies for health, both internally and externally, and I really like to encourage people to choose maybe one or two plants and make as many things as you can with just those one or two and really get to know that plant really well.
One of the other things that I really found compelling in the book was also that while there are a lot of challenges that the contemporary women healers you profile face, they seem like they're probably challenges that a lot of women before them have also had to face in the healing arts. But some of them seem particularly contemporary, and one of them is herbalism in an era of habitat destruction and lowering of plant and animal diversity on the globe. Can you talk about any of the women in regards to what's going on now?
Yeah, one of the women I interviewed in particular, Phuntsong Wangmo, she's a physician from Tibet, and that was a very serious issue for her. She grew up in Tibet. She was told that she would be a doctor. That was how it was done when she was a child and an adolescent. Your parents chose your career for her, and so her parents decided that she would be a physician, which she was actually happy about, because she wanted to be a physician because her older brother was. And so he took her under his wing and helped her get through medical school. And she thrived in it and became a very well-respected doctor, and eventually moved to the United States, and she's in Massachusetts running a Tibetan medical school. And one of the things that she impressed upon me was the loss of habitat for the plants that she's familiar with, both in the U.S. and in Tibet. That habitat is definitely being threatened. She said sometimes it's hard to find the plants that she needs. Her locus for plants is very specific. For instance, she would harvest, say a plant was growing all over a mountainside, both sides of the mountain. Based on their traditions and the way they use these plants, perhaps only the plants on the southern side of the mountain would be harvested, because the plants on the northern side acted in a completely different way. But if the plants on the southern side of the mountain were being, if that southern side was being developed or over-harvested, especially for companies that sell wholesale herbs in great quantities, she couldn't get the plants that she needs. So that was a big issue for her. Also for Kate Gilday, she's another herbalist I profile. She's a wonderful Western herbal practitioner in the Adirondacks in New York. And that was an issue for her, too. She said, you know, it's really, it kind of breaks her heart to see that a lot of the herbs that are so integral to this heritage are fading away. And to thankfully, to address that problem, there is an organization called United Plant Savers. I believe it's unitedplantsavers.org. And they were created specifically to educate people about the loss of habitat for medicinal plants and to help save those plants. So it's definitely an issue that's being addressed because it's widespread and it's unfortunate, but hopefully we can reverse that.
And some of the plants are going, are becoming more endangered actually because of demand for their use medicinally. Like I think of golden seal being over-harvested in the U.S., for instance.
And ginseng, it's a shame now that herbal medicine is getting the praise and the interest that it is. On one hand, that's wonderful, and on the other hand, it's kind of frightening because the plants that we rely on, there just aren't enough of them to meet the demand. So it's a huge issue. You know, how do we continue this heritage and preserve the knowledge of these particular plants without killing them off in the process?
And do you have a website where people could learn more about you and the book?
Definitely, it's vineyardherbs.com. VINEYARD herbs. I'm on Martha's Vineyard. So there are there's a lot of information about the book and products I sell in my apothecary and the school that I run, welcoming new students all the time.
Could you maybe end the program today with a couple thoughts on Cascade Anderson Geller, since she was a local herbalist here for a long time, and I think probably our listeners would be interested in hearing about her.
Yeah, she impressed upon me during our interview that she was a rebel. She was quite rebellious. She entered herbalism through rebellion, and in her early formative years, she was a political activist and really came into herbal medicine as a way of ditching other responsibilities and moving on her own path, which a lot of us can really relate with. You know, most parents don't want their children to grow up to be herbalists. They want them to do something productive or successful or lucrative, and Cascade seemed to be very much an enjoyable rebel. And I think she, I'm sure, had a huge following in your area and is much missed. She did a lot for people, I think especially young people, because one of the things she told me was she really wanted to make medicines for each person, you know, very personal and very delicious and very welcoming. She wanted people to welcome their medicines instead of just having to swallow a pill or, you know, not relate with it. She wanted people to connect with those plants, and I really commend her for that.
It must have been a fun enterprise for you to travel everywhere and meet all of these women.
You know, I didn't travel everywhere. I traveled quite a bit, but not everywhere. I would love to go to some of these other countries that I wasn't able to get to and meet with these women. They're all so extraordinary. But it was very eye-opening. You know, I learned so much throughout this process. It took me 7 years. I started writing the book in 2008. So it's been a long project and a very rewarding one. I'm so grateful to have had the opportunity to meet a lot of these women and to share their stories and to learn what I learned.
Well, thanks for being on Health Watch, Holly. The book is not only just a very informative book, but it's also a beautiful object full of great pictures and maps and such, too. So people should definitely check it out.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
We are talking today with herbalist Holly Bellabono, the author of Women Healers of the World, The Traditions, History, and Geography of Herbal Medicine. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center. While cinema provides entertainment and escape, for many filmmakers and viewers, it is a vital portal into the lives of others, a medium of engagement, and a powerful tool for social action. Films will be shown from Thursday, October 6th through Wednesday, November 9th, and include the films Familia, Sing Your Song, An African Election, Windfall, and more. Again, that's Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center, located at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information about the films can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And stay tuned. Next, Jenka Soderberg will be interviewing Alex Gates, a student at PSU. And we'll go to that in just a moment. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the psychedelic roots rock of Moon Alice, performing Thursday, October 23rd with the Garcia Birthday Band at the Alhambra Theater. The Alhambra is located at 4811 Southeast Hawthorne in Portland, and tickets for Moon Alice on October 23rd are available at alhambrapdx.com.
That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police.